Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we're tackling a film again. And before I talk about the film, let me introduce you to our co-hosts. Joining me here in the studio is Matt.
Hey,
Matt.
Hello, how are you going?
And via international satellite links and down and up converters, it's John Flowers.
Hello there.
So you're back from Vegas, and I understand that that you cleaned up.
I didn't do badly.
Okay,
let's just leave it at that.
Nice to know. Funding has been secured for the next round of that post show and that media show. Hey, and we'll talk about what you guys are all up to later. Let's get straight to our film. And this week we're going to go sort of retro, and in the sense we're going to come up and discuss a film you can get on DVD or on iTunes, and it's a Russian film called Night Watch. Now, John, I'm going to let you introduce it because, quite frankly, the reason we're reviewing it is because you suggested it.
Well, glad to hear that, or sorry to hear it, depending on how the review goes. So this is an interesting film. This is a film by a Russian director who basically got his start as a director for a Roger Corman film called The Arena, although he had done something prior to that. He did something in 1994. No one had ever heard of it. The Arena is also titled Gladiatrix, if you're looking for that particular film. But the film is Night Watch, and Night Watch is interesting because it was the first big-budget Russian film really after the fall of the Soviet film industry. The Soviet film industry had some real problems, and there was a television station called Channel One that tried to finance this film, and they were so impressed with the dailies or the footage that they saw that they thought, you know what, this doesn't need to be a TV show, it needs to be a film. So rather than have a four-part miniseries, the government-owned TV channel, Channel One, decided to turn it into a feature film and raised the budget to a reported $4.2 million U.S., which, frankly, is a pretty small budget given this film.
Yeah, I guess the reason that I was... Okay, firstly, I didn't notice it when it came out. Did you, Matt?
Yeah, I was in the middle of making my very own incredibly low-budget feature film, so when it came out, we were... all had to race to the cinema to see it because while ours was not quite as 4.5 or 4.2 million US, we wanted to see what we were up against and what other people were doing with very low budgets. And I think it was great.
Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. I didn't realize that. So you're talking about when you were filming Gabriel.
Yep.
And so you and the guys went and saw it. So you gave it the thumbs up. John, I presume you gave it a thumbs up.
Yeah, I did. I should point out that the film is extremely complex with a lot of characters, a lot of interwoven stories. Obviously it was in Russian, very difficult to follow. And, you know, they did something with the subtitles that made them really clever, but also just extraordinarily difficult to follow given all the action and everything on screen as well. I loved it.
Well, The film itself, as you say, is a dark kind of piece. And I guess we're going to now assume that everyone who wants to see it has seen it, because we're going to definitely be, violating any kind of hope of holding out on what the story is going to be. So if you haven't, don't want any spoilers, don't listen kind of thing. But the film is convoluted and... I guess it's not a film that would normally attract me because, for a start, I'm not into the horror genre that much. You know, I like a nice, happy film with happy people and witty things. And also because it was a foreign film and I thought I was going to have to work for it, and therefore, and it was low budget, and I'm thinking, well, yeah. I have to say, I only watched it because John recommended it. And, you know, John's a good guy, so figure, yeah, all right,
yeah, well,
he says.
He likes good films, so, you know.
Yeah, we'll trust him.
Yeah.
And I was kind of really pulled in, I guess, in the first 10 minutes, astonishingly pulled in by both the visual effects, the subtitles, as you mentioned, and just seemed to be kind of an interesting story. How did you come across the film, John? Did you just hear about it before it was released? Did somebody recommend it to you?
I'd been following Roger Corman for a long time, and I saw that this guy who did Night Watch, whose name I will inevitably butcher, but I believe it's Timur Bekmambetov.
Yes, and if it's all right with him, we'll call him by his first name because it's easier to call him Timur than it is to Bekmambetov. which I butchered from an Australian accent's point of view. If he doesn't mind, I apologise about that. But I'm sure you'd appreciate that it's with no malice of intent. So I counted 6 cinematographers on this, plus Steadicam operators. And I believe I'm right in saying there was just about every visual effects artist that sort of everyone that was sitting around in Russia working on it. So this has got to be what you'd call a collaborative effort.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. I read somewhere that there were over 100 visual effects artists total on the film. And there's a scene that we'll get into later, but there's a scene that is actually a single visual effects shot that is 100 seconds long.
Okay.
Which is just staggering to me.
The film was going to have a couple of hundred shots for this and its sequel that was being shot back to back. And in fact, I think it ended up, if I'm right in saying this, at 400 shots for the first movie alone. So we're going to stay focused on the first film, Night Watch. But John, just give us the rundown on the fact that there is a second film with even more visual effects called Day Watch, isn't it?
Yeah, Day Watch. And Day Watch is, if you think Night Watch has some special effects for the budget, Day Watch is just, it's out of control. And then there's, in fact, another film, actually 2 more films. There's Twilight Watch, and then I believe there's another film that they're tentatively calling The Final Watch.
That's what I like about a trilogy, going for the 4 films.
Yeah. Yeah. In the spirit of Hitchhiker's Guide, it's a 4 4 of them in the trilogy.
And so the next one is Twilight Watch, is that right?
I believe the next one is Twilight Watch, although, okay. Yeah, like I say, Day Watch has already been released. Twilight Watch, according to what I've read, is going to be called Twilight Watch everywhere except for the U.S., and in the U.S. it's going to be called Dusk Watch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get into the visual effects then, and just, you know, as we do, like to review the film from a as much as we can a visual effects point of view, as opposed to a film critique. We've already established that you guys liked it a lot. I liked it quite a lot. I wouldn't say it was like, you know, my all-time favorite top 10 film, but, you know, had some nice things. Now, you guys probably know because you saw it at the cinema. Was it just me or was there a laser pointer on the opening titles?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it was a laser pointer, but I think that...
It's like a little dot that's scanning around. And I was wondering if they tried to make it look like there was someone with a laser pointer in the cinema. And I watched it on like high quality, but it was a download, right? Not a cinema experience.
Right. Yeah, there is a weird laser. And what I think is happening there, although I can't be 100% sure, what I think is happening there is it's a little bit of foreshadowing for one of the effects that happens later, the eye effect and the red effect where you get to see membranes and things like that. So I think it's a little bit of dramatic foreshadowing because there's an awful lot of that sort of strange red dot-based effect in there.
It's just my level of critique is it a laser pointer? And your level of critique is dramatic, what did you just say?
Dramatic foreshadowing.
Yeah, whatever he said. Okay, well, you already mentioned, John, the supers. So let's discuss those because I don't remember ever being astonished by subtitles.
Yeah. Well, you never are, right? They're subtitles. They're white. They're yellow. They're just there.
Yeah, and I once saw a film in France, actually, where it was subtitled for the French, and I was in English. So I would break out laughing about 2 beats before the rest of the audience got to read it, and then they'd all laugh, which was a great David Lynch film. But other than that, I don't have much to give in the way of things to do with subtitles because no one ever pays any attention to them, except for, Matt, in this case... We, John and I, have seen it with these awesome subtitles, and you didn't get that, right?
I can't remember where I saw it at the cinema, but I watched the film again this week, and I got the, we'll just take it easy on a Sunday evening, we're just going to do a really cheesy English voiceover dub of the entire film. So I didn't get sexy subtitles this second time around.
So there is a release going out there where it's just all dubbed into English with bad lip sync. But let's assume that's the version we're not going to talk about, which is going to exclude Matt from this next part of the conversation. John, you want to take us through what sort of things they do with the subtitles?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what is going on with the subtitles. I mean, there's a lot of movement, and it seems like they wanted the subtitles themselves. It's almost like they knew this thing was going to be difficult to watch because it is complex and brooding and all of everything else going on. So they wanted the subtitles themselves to be kind of a character in the film that related to the different aspects of each of the plot points that was going on in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the first thing that I noticed is that characters were wiping off and on subtitles. So a character moves through frame, the subtitle actually gets removed from the picture by their body moving through. And then I started noticing that they were tracking them so that they'd zoom up, or literally like zoom while tilting, and the subtitle would get bigger and come off the bottom of the screen as if it had been sitting in the set for real. Now, it didn't look like it was composited in there, but it certainly looked like it was sitting on top and moving empathetically with the camera motion. And I was thinking, oh, well, somebody's got playing around with this. But fairly early on, when a character is swimming, a boy is swimming in the water, his subtitles actually turned from solid text to what would look like if blood was in water. In other words, a kind of vapory, animated particle system. And that's the point that I was like, wait a second. Somebody isn't just having fun with these. Somebody's like really gone to town on these. And I started thinking, how many subtitles could there be in a film that you would hand animate? Not everyone is hand animated, but I mean, that's like an astonishing amount of kind of stuff to do, given that it's low budget, right? Like, the theory is you don't have a lot of money in the first place. So one of the first things that you'd imagine would get cut at the production meeting is, well, no one's going to complain if the subtitles are normal. Let's save our money. But unless that was funded separately when Fox Searchlight came in and gave them extra money, they'd know what to do with it. But
yeah, I think they started doing the sexy subtitles for the international release, which debuted in London. And I think before that, it was actually a different cut. They'd, for the international version, they put some old stuff back in and they took some stuff out. And it's actually 10 minutes shorter, the international release, compared to the original Russian release. I think it was one of those organic kind of projects which, you know, started off as a TV series. Wait, you know, this has got a bit of promise here. Let's turn it into a feature. Wow, everyone likes it. Let's sell it around the world and give it a bit more love. I mean, I think Fox only paid like $4 million for the international distribution rights for it. So,
but when you saw it at the cinemas, did it have it? Because actually Australia got to see this film 6 months before the US did.
This seems so long ago.
Yeah.
It's gone from my mind.
I think you would have noticed if it had been
2005, I think, when it was in the US.
Yeah. According to our research, it was released in February 06 in the USA, and it was released in October 05 in Australia.
I was in the middle of London. Really long shoots and not sleeping much for several weeks. So.
Okay, so let's leave off the subtitles then, and the sort of, and though that is a continuing beat throughout the whole film, almost straight away we've got the battle on the bridge that is the ultimate clash between good and evil. And the freezing effect. And of course, 2005 still would have been very possible to do that as a digital effect. But as I understand it, John, this was pretty much done in camera.
Yeah. In fact, that entire scene was apparently all in camera up and until they pull away from the bridge. When the ravens start appearing, the ravens and the vortex and all of that, when that starts appearing, then it goes digital. But up and until that, it was practical. And in fact, what you see in this film is just a shocking number of practical effects.
There was some CG added to have some frozen elements in the air in the battle sequence, but the actors certainly were just asked to freeze on the spot. And that is an effect that, I mean, we discussed in Heroes, actually, they're doing the same thing, just getting the actors to freeze in position. But it was pretty darn effective, I thought.
And, you know, old school, low budget, you've got to go with what you can.
And there were other effects in here, like there's a scene that almost immediately at the end of that where one of the characters ages, a morphing effect. But even on those sort of more classic effects, I thought they were basically producing them really, really well. The only place in that opening sequence that it felt that, like, I mean, we could have to come at this and say, you either judge it as, was it really good for $4.2 million or was it really good full stop? And I don't know if it's fair to just pick one or the other exclusively.
For me, an awful lot was lost in translation. It had a different rhythm. in a different construct to, I guess, an American Hollywood action.
No, but I'm saying, like, if you're judging the effects, do you judge them based on these are amazing effects to pull off full the budget, or do you just say, full stop, that was a good shot? And I think there are places in this that it was full on just a good shot.
Yep.
There are places where, like, that pull out from the bridge that, well, John, you said was the first point that it went fully CG.
Right.
Like, that didn't have the hallmarks of a, you know, current level realism. I mean, it looked CG.
Sure.
Did it look crappy for the budget? No. But if you'd seen that shot in a major Hollywood sequence, you'd say that shot let that sequence down. Do you see where I'm coming from, John?
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. And I think that that's a fair thing to say is, you know, do you judge the film based on the budget or do you judge it based on, you know, just how good it is? And I think it's important to look at the special effects from both perspectives, because as you said, there are certainly scenes in here in the film where, I mean, if the budget had been $150 million, I still would have been impressed with some of the work that they did.
What was, I guess, just jumping ahead then, from that opening sequence and the fight, what was the most impressive for you visually? If you had to name a sequence that just really, you don't care what the budget is, they just nailed it.
Well, I mean, there are two things. One of them is a little weird, but so there's this other world called the Gloom.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gloom is this sort of sinewy, like, it almost looks like blood splatters and spider webs with mosquitoes flying around and darkness creeping in. And I just thought that was genuinely good in almost every aspect of it. I thought that, you know, someone really sat down and did a lot of design work to try and understand what would this gloom look like.
Yeah, everything seemed to have a reason and a place in the film. I don't think the effects were just thrown in there. So they really stylized this whole wonderful environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think gloom was very well done, but probably not in of itself. It was more like a really well-executed interpretation of something that could otherwise have been cheesy, as opposed to a whiz-bang, you know, mega effect. Like, it didn't scream ta-na in the way that, say, flipping the truck over did coming out of the tunnel. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the flipping the truck over was, I also thought, pretty impressive.
I mean, for me, that's one you see on paper and go, cripes. And actually, I should say that we have to judge this to a certain extent, that this is pre-Batman flipping a truck, which I still think is the best that's been done, but it's very recent and on a vastly bigger budget. Then for flipping a truck, it was a combination of real trucks, CG trucks, and real trucks again. And would, on paper, you'd have thought just been a killer. I mean, look, put your indie hat on for a second, Matt. I mean, if you'd seen that on paper, how would you have approached it?
An awful lot of close-ups.
What about you, John? You got your indie hat on and you get that in the script. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm thinking similar to what they did, which is I'm thinking of a frame from a junkyard and, you know, some hydraulics and a hell of a lot of CG.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd try Matt's solution first, which is, could we do the whole thing from the what it's like to be in a car that's going upside down? I haven't seen that before. And then build a gimbal so that we didn't have to see it in one take. And if the director was adamant about the one take flip, then I'd be like, could somebody be running towards it while that happens so it isn't like a locked off camera where you can just pick it apart?
Yeah. Foreground obscuring objects and maybe tucking a little miniature behind.
But
I think, I mean, there was a lot of ramping around that scene, which seemed slightly cheesy, but I think, like the fight scene at the beginning, they kind of set this expectation of this kind of flow of effects. So you kind of roll with it and you buy into the story. It's a vampire film. It's not going to be incredibly over-realistic. It's going to have a bit of fun and, I don't mind a bit of ramping and crazy bus flipping.
I mean, the shot that I can't get past, actually, say the truth, the shot that I was like, looks really cool, he's actually not in the film. It's in the end credits where the guy gets slammed by the truck. Like, that to me was just a full-on... Boy, if you ever wanted to say in 10 seconds or less, see the sequel, that shot of a guy standing there being just pummeled by a truck. Again, it was pre a similar effect in Fantastic Four with the Thing. And it was, you know, the bus crumpled, the guy got hit by it. It was, it said everything in, like, why I should see this sequel in 10 seconds. And also, I was like, wow, that was just, I actually called Matt over, didn't I? I was like, this shot. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, watching it back on DVD, I was like, is this supposed to be there? I'm going to watch it again. Ooh, I'm glad I did that.
But hey, it's in the film, so let's talk about it. Did you like that shot, John?
I thought it was great. I should also point out that that shot was like a lot of other shots, like the elevator coming through the rooftop at the end.
Yeah.
And many, many other shots. That particular shot was done nearly 100% practical.
Wow. I thought the elevator shot looked practical. I thought the shot of the guy... I mean, I just didn't stop to think. No, I tried to stop and think, but I didn't know how they pulled off the truck, because I thought that was... like, if you put that in any movie, I was happy with it. You know what I mean? That was the shot for me that I... When I was alluding to it a moment ago with you, John, which shot you'd have pointed to, that was the one for me that there was no doubt that I was like, okay, that was a really good effort. I don't care what budget you're on. If you pull off that shot, that's well done. In a commercial, in a budget film... In a big budget film, I'm happy with that shot.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, now that I realize there's so many practical effects in this film, it explains why there's a million stunties at the end in the credits.
Right.
I was really surprised at how many stunties. I didn't think there were that many actors in the entire film. But obviously, you're going to need specially trained people if you're going to be doing this many practical effects.
So
yeah, and for that scene, just to touch on it a little bit, for that scene at the very end, like the scene with the elevator coming out of the roof... one of the things that was really interesting is my understanding of it is that they basically rebuilt the front end of the truck, or the bus, I guess, that hits the old man standing in the street. And the old man in the street, they dug a hole into the ground, pretty deep, and put like a T-post, you know, a solid metal T-post into the ground. And then I believe they cemented the T-post, you know, let it harden, all of that, and then drove the truck with the recreated front end into it and filmed it at, you know, some ridiculous frame rate, 100 frames a second, 120 frames a second. And then almost everything in there is practical, right? I mean, the only thing that's not practical is a lot of compositing and digital replacement so that the guy's face looks like a real face.
Mm.
And it works. Yeah. I mean, it really works.
It's staggering.
And it's one of those things where you go, for the love of anything, if you're watching the film, don't switch off the beginning of the end credits roll, which, you know, a lot of people do. Because it's not just a good reason to watch the second film, but it's just a cracker of a shot. Hey, if I could break the truce for a second, what didn't we like?
I go back to the cheesiness. Sometimes, once I start a film and I see a bit of cheesiness, I'm like, okay, now I know what I'm expecting. I'd much rather that than get to the end of the film and they throw a cheesy shot in, which drags me out. But overall, if I could get away with not having cheesy ramps and things like that, I'd be a bit happier.
For you, John, anything that didn't work?
Well, I'm a little bit more sensitive to the non-English film world, and some of that cheesiness is sort of required in the sense that it's you know, you're playing to a certain audience, and in this case you're playing to a Russian audience, and a Russian audience is expecting a certain level of you know, Hollywood-like effects, although they're obviously quite a bit behind in general on the way that they do film. So the cheesiness didn't bother me nearly as much. The two things that drove me absolutely out of my mind were the freaking doll with the spider legs.
Oh, yeah. What was that doing there?
My God, that felt like a cliche of a cliche of a story that had already been told.
I thought it was a scene from Toy Story. Holy crap.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like something from Toy Story. It felt like something that, I mean, that wasn't cheesy to me. That was just so cliche as to be embarrassing. I mean, even for, you know, whatever the audience is, I know these guys have seen that before. Come on. And then the girl, right around the same time, the girl morphing into the tiger.
Mm. Yeah.
That really bothered me.
See, the age morph didn't bother me earlier on because I thought it was a valid, you know, time accelerating kind of thing. But yeah, that one was, I guess the thing for me that I was, I'm kind of critical of is heat haze. And there were a bunch of heat haze shots of the exhaust pipe of their vehicle and the jet liner heat haze, where it was just, okay, we want heat haze in here, no more. And, you know, heat haze just doesn't, it isn't that strong, and it dissipates quickly, and it has certain optical properties. It doesn't happen in any angle at any...
That's part of the cheesiness, though. You know, they've got to ham it up. I mean, I've never seen a council truck that's got giant rockets on the back of it. But
yeah, but that's funky.
If I did, I imagine it would have a ridiculous heat haze. I mean...
Well, can I ask a kind of a silly question that may actually get me kicked out of the cool kids club, which is...
Are we in the cool kids club already?
Don't start. Does it seem like Christopher Nolan saw this film? The reason I say that is because, you know, you've got the Joker driving around in this truck that's like kind of wild and crazy, and he's driving it sort of insanely. And you've got a truck flipping over. I mean, there are some very strong similarities between a few of the scenes in The Dark Knight. Almost like he's nodding his, you know, like making a, like winking or tipping his hat.
John, you sound like, you're acting like you've never heard of the apocalypse.
Conspiracy theory.
To quote a line from the film. I'm going to leave that alone. I also had a problem because I just, I'm not going to touch that. I had a problem with the punching bag of the guy that at the end, you know, the just keep punching him punching bag shot.
Yeah, but again, I buy it because we've set up Cheesetown, so, you know, I kind of roll with it.
Well, but I mean, have you guys seen any other, like, Underworld or any other film like that?
Foreign market experience is really great, happy films like Men on the Source and, you know, Jean
Life is Beautiful. Life is Beautiful.
Yeah, Life is Beautiful, which, you know.
I don't really do vampire films myself.
I do French.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've obviously seen Jean de Florette, given my name and everything, so.
That would be a good thing for you to see. And they are, unfortunately, films we can't review because of the lack of effects, but yes. Red, white, and blue. I like French cinema.
Right.
But, yeah.
But no, so I'm talking about, like, Underworld Evolution with Kate Beckinsale, which is not... I mean, that's an American film. And so the reason I ask about that is because it's the same kind of film. It is a war between vampires and werewolves. It's a war between the light and the dark. And, you know, if you think Night Watch is cheesy, I really urge you to take a look at something like Underworld.
Well, now,
you know, the dial is on 11 on that film. Which
wouldn't that be, if you think this is cheesy, I'd recommend you not looking at that film?
Well, actually, look, just to give you a perspective.
I understand that, like, the pulling your own spine out and using it as a sword, like, I get that that is, you know, whoa, cool in the you know, battle of good versus evil sort of stakes. I don't have a problem with that per se. I mean, it's not my cup of tea. But, or my latte, weak soy at the moment. But anyway, it's, you know, just that, I mean, now we're getting into sensitivities of, as you said, John, you know, this wasn't made for me. This was made for a Russian audience, first and foremost. And who am I to presume what a Russian audience is going to like, especially given how successful this was in Russia, which is extraordinarily successful.
Yeah, number one grossing film of all time at the box office.
Yeah, and so A, I applaud the filmmakers for doing it. B, I totally am impressed with what they managed to pull off at a budget. And C, there are a bunch of shots in there that I'm applaud them pulling off at any budget. So I'm not critical of it, but by the same token, I can only speak from my own personal point of view. And in my personal point of view, there were some areas of it that were... Also, to be fair, not only were they like a couple of bits a bit cheesy, there are a couple of bits that weren't as uber cool as I expected them to be, because then that's my taste in what I consider cool, right? I mean, the original Matrix, when those guys are in the black trench coats and stuff.
That was just cool.
It was just hot cool. Now, of course, that's become, you know, demonized by the, you know, High School Massacre crowd that, and I hate that. But yeah, so anyway, you can only discuss it from your own point of view. But it obviously worked for a Russian audience big time. Tell me, do you know, or does anyone know, John, that what level the actors were in terms of Russian culture at that time? Were they very well-known actors? Were they unknown actors?
My understanding is that some of them are pretty well known as television actors. For example, the main character Anton was played by Konstantin Kurbinsky. I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And he is pretty well known as a Russian horror actor. I mean, pretty seriously well known in the sense that, you know, the guy has like 50 films under his belt or something like that.
Hmm.
I know one of the women, was the host of the, by the way, the lead character was the host of the Russian Music Awards in 2004, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, that's the kind of celebrity that he had.
But he's also theater trained, right? Like I know that he did, you know, Hamlet and theater stuff.
Right. Absolutely.
I don't know whether he became famous after this, which I mean, I imagine would be the case, or he was already famous. But you could be right. It could be like he was famous in a television sense and became blockbuster in a film sense.
If he didn't beforehand, I'm sure he had his face on coffee mugs afterwards.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But were you about to say, was it Irina or somebody else you were about to refer to? Were you about to refer to one of the women? Because I thought Irina was really good.
I thought she was really, really quite good. And then I believe the guy who plays Geezer mm-hmm. was also fairly well known. In fact, I'm positive that he was the guy that Vladimir Minshov.
Right,
Minshov.
I actually would say that I thought the acting was definitely a notch or two above what I was anticipating. Because no disrespect to independent films, but oftentimes actors that are less polished in their craft are the actors that can be afforded for those productions. If you're lucky, you get a really great actor and it's a breakthrough performance, but then you don't tend to get that across the board. In other words, you'll get a couple of good leads, like you had a great lead in Gabriel and stuff, right? But then you can't, getting that at every level of the cast is like killer difficult when you're on indie film. And was there any characters in this that you just really winced? Because I was actually thinking that was pretty good casting and a pretty good ensemble, you know, supporting cast of, like, even the sort of extras had a realism about them and a validity.
You see, you got this version with the subtitles and everyone's normal voices. I got the special English version with special English voices.
Oh,
so there was a couple of characters there that was like, oh, my God, that's so painful listening to their voice. And you could tell that, you know, they were completely miscast for whatever voiceover they were doing.
Right, but, so you've got a problem with voice casting.
Yeah.
Okay, noted. John?
Action movements and stuff. Everyone looked great.
John, what about you for actual performances?
Well, I thought the two characters that were the weakest were the old woman at the beginning and the woman who played the ex-wife of the main character.
Right.
I thought that those were the two weakest characters for sure. And then I was a little disappointed to see that the woman who was the lead singer of the girl band, the four-person band, I was a little disappointed in her performance as well. But everyone else's performance I thought was pretty seriously good. Not that I speak Russian, so I couldn't tell you, but the inflection felt right, you know? It just felt like the emotion was there.
Mm. Yeah, I do think it's actually valid that on a foreign film, you can pick up a sense of the performance from the voice without, if you're skipping the subtitle atrocity that you had to witness, Matt. the overdub. I think you can get it. I think you're absolutely right, John. You can get that from... and so I definitely was quite comfortable at places to not get every line of dialogue. When I thought I knew what was going on, I wasn't, you know, forcing myself to read every line at the bottom of screen. If there's a fight going on and a bit of yelling going on, then I'm...
You kind of get the gist.
I kind of get the gist of it, yeah. Toby, there was a lot of birds in this, or ravens.
Yeah, there were ravens.
Let's discuss those for a second. Anyone want to hazard a guess how they were done?
So I can toss in a little bit of it. The ravens, I should set this up a little bit. The ravens are part of something called the vortex. And the vortex is anytime the light world and the dark world and the real world collide, creates this kind of vortex effect with these ravens. It's kind of like a vulture hovering around someone who's dying. And so the idea is that these ravens kind of spill between worlds and swirl around through this vortex. And so what you see is you see not five or six ravens, but tens of thousands of ravens, and like the case at the very end. And I happen to know pretty much a lot of how that was done.
Well, for example, in this, the lift sequence, debris falls off the roof and turns into birds on the way down.
Yep.
Do you want to discuss that one?
Yeah, a lot of that was done with 3D Studio Max.
So debris 3D, birds 3D, or one or the other live action?
The debris was real. The birds were not.
Okay. I mean, I thought that was effective when it happened.
Yeah, there may have been cases where the debris itself was not real, but for the most part, the debris was being shot off the roof with what the director referred to as a pneumonic cannon, but I suspect it's a pneumatic cannon.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It's safe bet. Though, you know, if I tried saying anything in Russian, it would be just worse than that. So
right. So there was an awful lot of that, and as you know, I mean, that entire rooftop and everything around it was a set that was designed by the set designers. Mm-hmm. So they had a lot of latitude with the amount of stuff they could just hurl off the edges or how it could break. Just very interesting.
I actually thought that just watching it, I thought the ravens might have been, you know, live action plates just dropped on the top, because most of the time that I saw them were like wide shots of the buildings.
See, I thought
that's
why I referenced, when John said he had a handle on it, that's why I referenced that shot, because each piece of debris translates into a bird. And so I was thinking, well, that blows that theory, because he wouldn't have been able to map accurately enough birds to debris if you'd use plates. I mean, I would definitely have gone shots of ravens in those wide shots, as you said, but I'm just taxing my brain now. Were there a lot of other shots where that sort of effect happened, like debris turning into ravens type stuff?
There were shots where something turned into a raven, where ravens appeared out of the vortex with just, you know, debris. Yeah, there's an awful lot of that going on. The problem, of course, is, and this is actually genius in a way because of the budget, the film is so dark, and I don't know if you noticed, it has...
actually mean dark now. You don't mean...
No,
I mean
visibly dark. Yeah. Yeah. Not dark, sinister.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although it is both of those. There are, I think, I was going to say seven, but I think there might be eight distinct color palettes that they're using. You know, one of them is this really washed out kind of traditional blue in the spirit of, you know, the sort of cranked, you know, way too far.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is kind of a magenta or red palette. And then the vortex one is very, it's a very desaturated look.
Mm.
And in addition to being desaturated, there's this enormous amount of, I don't know what kind of blur they're using, but it really looks like Vaseline smeared across a lens most of the time when that's happening. And I think that they're doing a lot of that to hide some of the visual effects. But the thing that's funny about it is, even, and I watched it on Blu-ray, I saw it a few weeks ago on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Even on Blu-ray, it still is remarkably good looking, even with that sort of smearing and color palette that they're using.
Do you know what they actually shot on, John? I've tried to find it, but I can't find anywhere that references what it was actually shot on.
Well, it was shot on film, for sure.
Yeah, it was shot on film because I found the lab that did the film transfer.
Yeah, but I don't know what kind of camera. I was able to find... I looked at several making of videos, and I was only able to find shots where they show the camera at such an angle that you really only see the lens.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
So they used a lens to make the film.
Yeah, excellent. Well, now we're really getting beneath the surface. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't either. I myself like to know those kind of things. I'm that much of a geek that it appeals to me what sort of camera it was. But yeah, I think that it's a fair bet to say that it's probably a pretty standard 35 kind of shoot.
Cool. It's only reason because a couple of the shots struck me as very, you know, over the 180 shutter kind of feel.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't look video-y.
For me, a couple of shots made me go, well, maybe. But, you know, the clarity was there in the highlights and nothing was blown out. So
there were highlights?
You know, there's a couple of day scenes, you know, when he's walking around the pool, when they go to the market and have a cup of blood, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The happy scenes.
The happy scenes in the butcher shop with the blood.
Yeah. Say, speaking of that, the tunnel scene where she's walking along, She seems to get like almost hit, if not actually hit by cars, before she gets the taunting of the blood out the window and the dropping of it. And I was looking at that and I was thinking, that's got to be either astonishing stunt work or somebody's doing something, because I'd have done that with digital cars. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's a minor little thing. She's walking around dazed, walking down the tunnel.
She just gets knocked around a little bit by the cars.
You get bumped a little bit by a car at that speed, you're dead.
I think there's an Aphex Twin video clip that does the same kind of thing.
Really? Those Aphex Twins, they're so clever.
I know, I love them.
Both of them.
But I did kind of like that.
Yeah, I like that. I like anything that is nice, because it was saying a lot without having to say anything. It was saying, you know, dazed, indestructible, manic, disorientated, but it wasn't having to scream it. It was just...
And keeps the audience wondering, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, well, I think generally, if we were to summarize it, we think John still has good taste.
Yeah.
I think John still is good. Though slightly dark, John, and I would be very worried about, you know... But apart from the dark side...
There's no doubt that there's a dark side to my taste in films. I have one last quick visual effects question, if we're moving on, which is the falling rivet. There's a 101-second long scene where a rivet falls from a plane onto a building through a shaft, bounces out and into a cup of coffee.
Yep.
What did you think of that?
I liked parts of it.
Yeah, that's the thing. For me, at some point, it was just a show-offy kind of, we're not going to... I mean, I like editing. I have this big problem with people that want to have continuous shots. Like, they're going to do one whole shot, never going to cut. And I'm like, the audience doesn't... If they're thinking about the fact you haven't cut, you've taken them out of the film. If you're going to do something that doesn't cut, then it needs to be, I think... Like in ER, the TV show, when they'll pick up a stretcher... And they'll take that into the examination room, spin around the actors a couple of times without cutting, because it's a sense of a whirling, disorientating, incredibly intensive, everything's going on, it's a ballet of people trying to save this person's life. Then I'm not pulled out of the film, but at some point, occasionally I go, my God, they haven't cut in forever, and wow. But it's really driving a plot point, that it would be like that, being in a whirlwind of kind of...
Like Children of Men. There's that scene in Children of Men where don't even notice that it hasn't cut.
Exactly. In this one, I noticed it didn't cut. And then, as I said, I'm a fan of editing. I think editing is terrific. I think there's editing, and I'm not looking at it now, but I'm pretty sure there's like three cuts in the guy hitting by the truck at the end when he's stepping out and we come around.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling ripped off. I didn't feel that they had to keep that in one shot. Otherwise, I felt like it wasn't a good sequence.
It made it punchier,
yeah. And the, so pet hate time, think that trying to not edit is actually not a good thing. And I didn't find Rope a compelling picture because Hitchcock didn't cut. But what did you think, John, of the rivet scene?
I thought, and this is a case where I actually thought the budget needed to be kept in mind. I thought for the budget, certainly that was pretty impressive. My understanding is that they used a lot of, they used an actual rivet for most of that.
Oh, really?
Once it falls out of the plane, and then a lot of compositing to get much of that done.
Yeah, I mean
imagine a lot of stills being stitched together and
yeah.
Well, look at this way. I mean, there are times that it's valid, right? The opening sequence of Forrest Gump with the feather. Yeah.
Right.
Now I thought for that film, especially as a title sequence, because titles have their own reason for being the way they are. Like, you have to consume a lot of time and you normally don't have dialogue, and you can make it an incredible establishing shot, so it opens itself up to having a continuous non-cutty kind of feel about it, right? I'm thinking also of The Player, another really, really long continuous shot that I thought was magnificent in setting up a world.
I wonder why they didn't use that sequence as the opening sequence with the opening titles.
I'm sorry?
No, I just said you have to wonder why they didn't use that as the opening title sequence.
Yeah, and if they'd used that as the opening title sequence, then I think it would probably have been more appropriate and more kind of fascinating, and what am I looking at? And you don't need dialogue, and it's a connection of a whole lot of different things kind of thing. And I feel that's a... There's like a... the exception to the rule previously stated is the in the opening title. So at the beginning of a film at around the establishing shot time, then you can really often drive an audience in by a continuous shot. And I think both in the case of Forrest Gump and The Player, both two films that I think worked exceptionally well doing that, they are valid. Didn't hate it in this, just didn't go, yeah, wow, cool, that's my favourite shot of all time.
The other shot in Night Watch, which that particular rivet shot reminded me of, was earlier on when we do a zoom through the train, through the tunnel, through the train, and
right,
then reach
yeah.
And I love that shot. I saw that and was like, that's awesome. I want to steal that.
And you know what? I didn't mind the hiding of the bodies to just see the arteries stuff, which is obviously CG, right? But I didn't mind that at all either because, you know, it's a vampire and they're going to see things in terms of blood. Like, I thought that was an interesting thing. There were definitely some nice takes that showed, I think, that they were free to experiment, you know? Like,
and that's part of the joy of, you know, low-budget filmmaking. You get to experiment and you have a bit of latitude and forgiveness from the audience, and especially if you're doing a vampire film. Because you
definitely do. And I think the audience will go with you. You're absolutely right. And I think an independent filmmaker that doesn't take advantage of that is, in some ways, acting more like a wannabe than embracing their audience. Their audience will go with them, I think. I mean, you guys are both more indie filmmakers than I am. Would you agree with that assertion, John?
Yeah, I think you have to take chances and trust that the audience has a nice sense of, you know, the visual story that you're telling.
I think there's a very restrictive Hollywood-esque camera style that when somebody's allowed to go beyond it can be really quite interesting and engaging. You know, when somebody's allowed to do things because they're not stopped from doing them because they want to play it safe, that can be pretty darn interesting. And I mean, obviously Fincher manages to take that to the next level and produce shots in things like Panic Room that, you know, almost have an indie feel or right. And are no longer indie, especially Fight Club. But I definitely think that that's one of the benefits that experimentation and the audience going with you, that I think the film is really interesting to see. And I wonder whether we'll see that in Twilight Watch. Tell me, John, he's gone on to do, because we spoke about one of his films, I'm sure, that was a more classic Hollywood film, right? Wasn't it?
Wanted.
Wanted? Right.
Wanted with Angelina Jolie, yeah.
And yet, you saw that. What did you think of that in comparison to this?
I thought it was, in a lot of ways, I thought it was Day Watch, just, you know, with a different plot.
Right.
There's a tremendous amount of things that happen in Day Watch that kind of happen in Wanted. Of course, you know, the budget is so much more.
Mm. Yeah, Angelina Jolie's trailer budget would be more than this film, certainly.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a scene in Day Watch where a car literally they jump a car and slide it across the side of a building.
Right.
That is, it's pretty impressive.
So this is one of the reasons why I haven't seen Day Watch yet. I've got it. I'll be watching it in the next couple of days. But it's, again, the cheesy factor. It takes me out of a film and I don't know. It's another reason why I haven't seen Wanted as yet.
Yeah. You have to surrender yourself in a way to the sort of artificial world that's being created.
I just find it easy to do that with sci-fi. Like, I can surrender myself. I mean, I'll admit it, right? I'll admit it. I will surrender myself to a Star Trek film, and I'm totally there, right? I'm going to go see the new one, even though it looks dorky. And, you know, but I don't know. Somehow, you're right. Like, in Wanted, set in the modern day, when they flip a car over a car and shoot through the sunlight. So I'm just through the sunroof. I'm like, there are about 1,000 bits of physics going on in my head as to why that's not going to work and how it's not going to work, and
especially when
bending bullets.
Effects films these days are trying to make things more realistic. So I guess it's hard to, yeah, like I said, if you go to see a film and you see a cheesy thing at the start, then I'm rolling with it for the rest of the film. I know what the expectation is. And that's why these films get away with it.
Is there a film like this that you've seen that you totally bought into?
I'm trying to think. Was Get Smart? Get Smart was one that seemed cheesy at the start and I rolled with it.
Okay.
I
think, John, you centrally reject the central premise of cheesiness because you think it's appropriateness to an audience, right?
Well, I think that each genre of film has its own kind of area where it seems like, you know, it can't be real, and you have to suspend disbelief. I mean, you talk about The Matrix. You know, to me, The Matrix is a great example of a film where you just have to let go. And if you don't let go, you just won't get into it. I mean, it reminds me, there's a group in Russia, which is this intellectual movement, this underground intellectual movement, who's really into vampires and parallel worlds and all these things. They're called the Podonki. And they openly criticized this film for its, you know, Hollywood style and its lack of ideas and its, you know, ridiculous visual effects. And they actually called the movie, I'm going to mispronounce it, but Nochnoi Pozor, which is Russian for night shame, because they really just hated the sort of, quote, cheesiness, right? The unbelievable aspects of it.
Yeah, no, but we're probably getting now into the conference-going set, and pleasing them doesn't tend to please anybody else on the planet.
Right. I mean, there's a film with Mila Jovovich, and I'm trying to remember this. There's three parts. No, that's a different one. I can't remember the name of it, but there's a Mila Jovovich. Like it's on the third one now. I can't believe I can't remember the name of it.
Resident Evil.
That's it, Resident Evil. And you know, Resident Evil is incredibly successful. And once again, you just kind of have to surrender yourself to this sort of hyper real world.
But I mean, let's not beat around the bush. It was important that this film worked for the Russian film community, and it worked in spades, and good on them. You know what I mean? Like, if they had to add a bit of cheesiness to do what this film did to the Russian film industry, which was put it on the map, give it, you know, a good solid dose of we can do it, and employ a hell of a lot of visual effects artists, then bring it on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I approached it as a, you know, a low budget film with, you know, not a huge film industry to get behind it, and I loved it from that aspect. I mean, I'm not a big vampire film watcher, and I wouldn't go to see it because I liked vampire films, because I don't. But the reasons why I wanted to see the film, I was rewarded tenfold.
Yeah, if somebody asked me to describe it, I wouldn't describe it as a vampire film. It's funny you keep doing
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Because it is.
No, I know, but it is and it isn't. It isn't like a... For me, a vampire film is, you know, teens running around in their underwear and getting, don't go in that room film.
We've moved a long way from the 80s, Mike.
Okay. I like the 80s. It was fun.
There's a really interesting rumor floating around in Hollywood right now. As you know, I do spend some of my time there. And it looks like, you know, the director of Night Watch is actually going to do an updated version of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, like a reimagined Moby Dick set in, I think, present day or something like that.
As long as they're not driving cars around the insides of a whale, I'd be there.
So
yeah, can I just say that the Moby Dick references in the I'm going to get shot for this, aren't I? In the Jean-Luc Picard Star Trek Attack of the Borg film was one of the finest uses of modern literature in a sci-fi stand-up in a built-up area. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that. Hey, John, thank you so much again for joining us. We really appreciate it. Matt's gone speechless.
I don't even know what to say.
Matt, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure as always.
John, people want to bug you, follow you, and stalk you. Where's the best place to find you?
If you go over to lifezero.org, I tend to collect whatever madness I'm involved in at the time on the front page.
All righty. And Matt, probably best to find you where?
Over at FXPHD.
And as you guys hopefully know, I'm to be found at fxguide.com. We just want to thank our producers and researchers and team. Christian Martin, who is our producer and head of the crew, is not only working hard with our other producers and researchers and stuff, but she's also working on a new website for the VFX show, which will be coming up. So we'll give you more of that in upcoming weeks. We want to thank them, Laurie and everybody, for contributing, and it's a big team effort. You want to see or leave some notes for us right now, you can do it over at pixelcore.tv. Not a lot of traffic there right now because, as I say, we're moving to the new site. But we do appreciate any comments you give. A lot of people, I think, give us comments on Twitter. And, John, your Twitter is
Life Zero. Yep.
And mine is Mike Seymour. And Matt doesn't like to be stalked, so he's not on Twitter, though he's hip to the jiggy stuff. But you're probably over on some Facebook.
Yeah, I'm on, you know, the cool old school Facebook, none of this new school Twitter craziness.
Yeah. All right. Until next time, guys, thank you so much. And we really appreciate you listening. See ya.